I didn't, you know, choose this way of life, this career, this profession to play it easy, because I think that there's so much at stake that I want my people to not, I don't care if they agree with me. I want them to be challenged. I want them to think.
Always a joy talking about politics. As I said on the last edition of the Squidiology podcast, we talked with an Episcopal priest. Over the next 2 months or so, we're going to have conversations with faith leaders of all types, all different religious faiths, about faith and politics. That intersection is sort of driving a lot of tension, my word, in our national conversation about our culture, certainly the politics of our country here. Today's guest is Rabbi Jacob Herber. I've known him for a few years now, a good friend of the show. First of all, thanks for joining me on this Squidiology podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I know who you are, but for the folks who don't, sort of give a quick bio, quick background on who you are, where you came from, and why you do what you do.
Sure. I'm the senior rabbi of Congregation Bethel, the oldest conservative synagogue in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We're located in Norfolk, Virginia. We're actually celebrating our 175th year as a congregation. I'm a conservative rabbi. I was ordained by the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City. I'm also a senior rabbinic fellow of the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, Israel. And I proudly serve my country as an auxiliary chaplain in the United States Coast Guard.
So for the folks who don't know, and I'm pretty sure I know where this is going to go, when you say conservative, you don't mean politically conservative.
No, you know, unfortunately, our movement's name is somewhat misleading. We're not conservatively political. I would say we are right there in the middle of the spectrum within Judaism of the Orthodox movement or Orthodoxy on the right and Reform and Reconstructionists or Reconstructing Judaism on the left. Hmm. So we believe in the we believe that Jewish law, halakha, is still operative and binding, but we seek to have that system of Jewish law and observance work in tandem as much as possible with modernity, with modern life.
When you think about your faith, and certainly we've talked a lot on my show and in the last few years, probably more than a decade, about the sort of the conflict in some cases, not always, between faith and politics. As someone who does what you do, who serves the Jewish community, and you've served in Wisconsin, I believe, you served out west on the western part of the United States, now, as you said, in Norfolk, Virginia. Where do you see that intersection playing out with your group, your members of your faith? Where does that intersection, where does it present itself? How do you approach it? And sort of lay it out for us, because each faith is obviously different tenets of each faith. But at least my lay person understanding is that most faiths try to get along is an easy phrase, but they try to be cooperative in how they understand and work with each other, recognizing that there are other faiths out there in the world. Is that a right way to put it?
Look, it's a great question. Conservative Judaism is, I would say, also a very big tent stream or movement of Judaism. And so you'll find people politically on the center left, and you'll find people on the center right, and then you'll find folks, you know, right in the middle. And that's actually why I really try to eschew speaking about partisan politics from my bima or my pulpit when I'm giving a sermon, because I recognize that there are people who have a wide variety of perspectives, and I want as many people to feel welcome as possible. That being said, the one issue that I will not hesitate to speak out about is the issue of Israel, support for Israel. And I think it's because it's such a core value of Judaism and the Jewish people, the one time where I will be vocal about what I think I want people to hear and think about.
Is there any disagreement among members of your community, the Jewish community that you serve, on the subject of Israel? And if there is, what would that be?
Well, you know, in my congregation, I would say that the vast majority of people are extremely supportive of Israel. They are Zionists, a word that unfortunately is misconstrued and misunderstood and unfortunately vilified in society today. That word simply means that we believe that the Jewish people have a right to self-determination and to live governed by Jewish values in our ancestral homeland. That's all Zionism means. And I would say that the overwhelming majority of my congregants believe that. And I think that in my movement, the vast majority of people believe that. And yet we also, like many Israelis, believe that the government of the state of Israel, just like the government of the United States, when it's appropriate, should be criticized if there's a policy that we believe is not right. We should speak out about it. There's a difference between that and saying that the country, the state of Israel, has no right to exist. So I think that's where most people fall. I also happen to be the rabbi of a congregation. You know, I live and work in a Navy town. Norfolk has the largest naval base in the world. The president of my congregation is a retired rear admiral, three-star admiral. Many of my congregants are either active duty, reserve duty, or veterans of the Navy or the Marines or the Coast Guard. And because of that, there are many of my congregants who believe very strongly in the essential and important strategic relationship that the United States and Israel has.
Has it surprised you or not that the sort of aftermath of the attack on Israel by Hamas, and you and I have talked previously about this on my show, has sort of increased? And if you do sense that, I'm based on our previous conversations, I'm pretty sure you do. Why is that? Why do you think that is? I mean, we see it on display, and we used to really see it on display in college campuses. There's been sort of a pullback from that, mainly because of reaction from the White House. But how do you see that?
I see it because we were from the get-go, no matter what Israel did in response to October 7th. If what happened on October 7th had happened to the United States, I think I stand on pretty firm ground in saying that whichever entity, whichever country did what they did, it would be literally flattened. And Israel, as a sovereign nation attacked by a terrorist organization where its citizens were brutalized, raped, mutilated, burned to death, men, women, and children, and then over 200 of them taken hostage and kept for, in some cases, over 500 days as captives in tunnels. For Israel to go and to respond to that, and every military expert, beginning with John Spencer, would tell you that despite all the propaganda and the visuals that you would see on television, the ratio, you know, of combatants to civilian casualties, the steps that Israel took, they are all, when compared to military operations and the wars and actions that our country has taken, you know, fighting ISIS, fighting Nazi Germany during World War II in Japan, that they pale in comparison to the casualties that were sustained through U.S. efforts. And because of that, from the get-go, Israel was going to lose the propaganda war. There was no way that Israel was going to win the propaganda war that got launched literally the day of the attack, when those student groups that you're talking about were already mobilized. There are emails that are public record from related to lawsuits that have been brought by the families of the hostages against many of the people involved with that campus demonstration movement, that show that they knew the attack was going to happen. They had signs ready, and they were already out trying to flip the narrative. You know, there's an inversion of what people were hearing. Instead of Hamas being the evil perpetrators, even before Israel actually launched its retaliatory war, weeks after October 7th, Israel is being vilified and called the enemy and the evil, you know, the evil ones. And Hamas and the Palestinians were being portrayed as the victims. So, you know, in the end, actually, and I think Israel cares more about winning the war and getting their people back than the unfortunate circumstance that the other side is going to win when it comes to, you know, the propaganda.
How do you think that propaganda or that narrative could be changed in this situation? We know that President Donald Trump is a strong ally of Israel. I'm a staunch advocate for the country of Israel. And you try to tell people that the demonization of a group of people based on their faith and their location in the Middle East is not a foundational argument that they should be eliminated or wiped off the face of the earth. But yet here we are. How do you change that narrative from your position?
You know, I think it's going to change when the government, in part, I think it's going to change when the government of Iran falls. And I think the government of Iran is going to fall because the people of Iran are out in the streets. If you want to talk about a liberation movement that deserves everybody's support, there are people who are hundreds of thousands in the street protesting their tyrannical, fanatical government. And I think actually this time they're going to prevail. And Iran has been a bulwark when it has come to supporting Hamas and Hezbollah, you know, and the Houthis. These are their proxies. And they have, like Qatar, they have pumped millions and millions and millions of dollars into this propaganda operation. And I think that when they are no longer in power and they no longer have influence, I think you're going to start to see that this propaganda campaign is going to really fall flat.
When you think about where we're at as a country right now, on the political side of things, so, you know, take your rabbinical hat off if you can do that. Probably, maybe you can't, because we all have our built-in biases and beliefs, and those are strong ones. Are you optimistic about the relationship between faith and politics in our country not Israel, but in the United States, and where we're at right now. Are you optimistic, pessimistic? Where are you at?
I wish I could tell you that I was optimistic, because I try to be an optimistic person. My community is really being squeezed by both ends. You know, there is the progressive left, and many religious leaders on the progressive left that used to actually be allies of the Jewish community. You know, we thought that we had allyship and feel very betrayed. And on the right, unfortunately, the rise of Christian nationalism. And the specter of both really makes it difficult to feel optimistic. That being said, by definition, you know, the Jewish people are an optimistic people. I don't think we'd be around, you know, over 2,000 years later, after two millennia of being exiled and being persecuted and oppressed wherever we were, and almost exterminated in World War II. So while I, in the short run, don't feel optimistic, I know in the end that people of good faith, they always prevail. And I think that we will, God willing, come to a point where those of us of good faith can not only lead our communities, but lead our country to the kind of unified place where we were not that long ago.
For a living, I communicate. It's my job, 2 hours every day, and more than that if you count all the digital work that I do and podcasts. But I believe in the power of words. And as a rabbi and a faith leader in the Jewish community, how would you shape your message to do what you just talked about? Ultimately, put it simply, layperson's view, good should triumph over evil. And that could be perception, that could be actions, it could be a lot of things. How do you shape your messaging to members of your community to sort of look forward to a more positive future? Not necessarily short term, as you talked about, but long term. How do you shape that message?
You know, last Saturday, on the Jewish Sabbath, there were lots of things I could have spoken about. I decided that I was going to give a sermon about what happened in New York City in the borough of Queens when a virulently pro-Hamas, anti-Semitic group again held a protest outside of a synagogue, which led the synagogue to cancel its religious services, which led the Jewish schools in the neighborhood to close for the day out of concerns for safety, and where they chanted, "Hey, hey, we support Hamas here," along with all the other usual, you know, slogans of globalizing intifada, statements about supporting jihad. And you know, the new mayor of New York City remained silent for over 24 hours. Even AOC publicly condemned what this group did. And so I gave a sermon about this, and I talked about because we're in the place in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, in the beginning of the book of Exodus, where a new king rises in Egypt. And I spoke about how our commentators say, you know, why didn't this king recognize or know about Joseph? Joseph saved Egypt. You know, he was legendary. And the fact is that this king, this new pharaoh, knew about Joseph, but he didn't care about Joseph. He didn't care about his legacy, and he didn't care about the well-being of his people, the Israelites. And I connected that to the history of the Jewish community in New York City, going all the way back to the founding of New Amsterdam, and how Peter Stuyvesant, who was the governor of New Amsterdam, was instrumental in trying to evict the Jews who were in New Amsterdam, now New York City, because they were Jews. And they were actually fleeing the Spanish Inquisition. Only to be told by the Dutch West India Company, his bosses, stop what you're doing. We value the Jewish community in New Amsterdam. Stop it. And I said, you know, Zora Mamdani is a modern day Peter Stuyvesant because he cares nothing about the contributions of Jewish New Yorkers, ultimately about their safety, even though he may, when pushed, utter some platitudes. And his, what he did on the first day after taking office, rolling back Mayor Adams's protections for the Jewish community, which would have prevented that demonstration from happening across the street from the synagogue. What he did enabled what happened to happen. And yet, after saying all of that, I ended by quoting one of my favorite rabbis, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, of blessed memory, the former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, who said, in essence, we are still here. You know, there have always been tyrants in our world and people who have wished us ill. They are no longer here and we are still here. And trying to share an optimistic message, despite everything that we've witnessed and felt, that we're going to get through this.
I spent some of my time with my previous conversations with faith leaders across many faiths asking about the personal side of this. When you approach your messaging to your community, how much, and this is sort of a nuts and bolts, but I'm always fascinated by it because I know what I put into my show and I know sort of the self-review and the criticism that I do internally. How much do you approach this from a, this is what I want to accomplish, this is how I do it, and how much of a struggle, how easy, how much do you enjoy that process as part of not the actual delivery of the messaging, but the construction of that message?
That's another great question. It speaks to the fact that you really appreciate, as someone who speaks publicly, that there's a skill involved in this and there's an approach. And I, you know, like you, I value every word that comes out of my mouth. And especially knowing that people will hear what they want to hear. And sometimes they won't hear what they actually were told. And another layer is that I believe that, you know, as a religious leader, sometimes you actually have to give the sermon that your people don't want to hear, but they need to hear it, which means that, you know, you may be going out on a ledge, but I didn't, you know, choose this way of life, this career, this profession to play it easy, because I think that there's so much at stake that I want my people to I don't care if they agree with me. I want them to be challenged. I want them to think. And if they happen to agree with me, you know, all the better. So I really try to, I always want to speak from my tradition. So I will always make reference to a text of Judaism. I believe in contemporizing it, making it relevant for people. Because, you know, my folks, I think my folks want to know, how do they look at the world around them? How do they understand the issues of the day, the events that take place through a Jewish lens, because their Judaism is important to them. And they want their Judaism to inform their lives. So I really try to find the sweet spot between teaching them something from my tradition or our tradition and making it relevant to their lives.
I often say that I know people are listening, you know, some days could be 100,000 people or more in the our area of the state of Wisconsin, I want them to lean in. They may not agree with what I'm saying, and I certainly don't want an audience that just nods their head in approval at everything I say, because that seems to me lazy and not really provide me any gratification. I want them to lean in, and certainly don't want them to lean back. So, I mean, I'd love the messaging there, because I think understanding the importance of facts, understanding the importance of making an argument, in your case, on the faith side of this a wonderful equation that we call life, I think is so important. It's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you on the podcast, because I think you understand that. And you said it clearly, that you want your members of your community to think about these things. I just love that sort of approach to doing what you do. And I knew when we had this conversation, before we had this conversation, it'd be rewarding. And I want to thank you for, one, sharing some of your time with us. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. And certainly presenting the perspective of the Jewish community, which I think is so important in this country and beyond. And as we have these faith conversations with many different leaders, I value our time together. It certainly is a message that I think is well received by me and hopefully by our audience.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to, you know, have these conversations with you. I'm honored, and I really, really appreciate you having me on.
My friend, Rabbi Jacob Herber from Norfolk, Virginia. Beautiful part of the country, by the way. I love that part of the country. Used to spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., so not too far away down the coast. We'll talk again in the future. You're going to be part of, as I said, a multi-episode editions of Scriptology related to faith and politics, and you've certainly served the conversation well today. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Looking forward to having more of these.